Okay, well, I'm delighted to now kick off our rapid guide to Resolve, in which we're going to give you a speedy overview of some of the highlights and headlines. Now, I must emphasise that these are merely snippets. Covering 5 years of work in 20 minutes is quite a challenge. But there'll be a chance to hear much more about all these things later during the day. So I'm going to start off by telling you about some of the carbon mapping work. Now, one of the key aims of Resolve is to provide robust, evidence-based advice for policymakers. And therefore, we wanted our work to be fully grounded in evidence from past history. So one of the first tasks was to investigate trends in carbon emissions. So an early piece of work was to set up a framework to explore trends in carbon from the consumption perspective, or the consumption effect, like Juliet was just talking about. So in doing this, we take account of all emissions due to UK consumption. And in this way, we include emissions embedded in the goods and services imported from abroad. So we take account of emissions that arise, say, in factories in China when they're manufacturing goods that are to be purchased by UK households. Now, at the time, this was groundbreaking work and even heretical, because what we found was that rather than UK emissions diminishing, as trumpeted by the government, in fact, they were actually rising when looked at in this way. And this showed us that to make real progress in reducing emissions, it's vital to use this consumption perspective accounting. So this bit of work set the scene, and it showed the enormity of the uphill job we were facing and are still facing. And the next task was to find out what is driving this increase. Is it purely down to economic factors, such as rising incomes and falling prices? Or is it more influenced by non-economic factors, such as changing lifestyles and behaviours? And this is vital information for policymakers in planning what types of measures to use to reduce carbon emissions. Which types of consumption is taxation likely to be effective for? And for which types of consumption will other measures be required? And Mona Chitness will tell you more about this work in her talk later this morning. Now also, projecting findings from this work has formed the basis for devising some future scenarios. And Scott Milne has depicted carbon intensity of UK household consumption over the next 20 years under a range of social, technological, economic, and political conditions. Now, there are lots of scenarios out there, but what's important about Scott's work is that, importantly, they use this consumption perspective, as I've just explained to you. Now, we can, of course, also learn a great deal about looking at the status quo, and we set out to answer questions such as, how much carbon is attributable to which types of needs and desires? Is the highest amount attributable to subsistence needs, such as food and shelter and clothing? Or is it due to our leisure demands? How great is the disparity between the carbon footprints of different segments of UK society, and what drives these differences? Now, the answers to these questions form a basis for untangling the complex interplay between the material, economic, psychological, social, and cultural forces that drive the emissions attributable to UK household consumption. One of our findings is that recreation and leisure activities account for over a quarter of an average household's carbon footprint. Now, I don't know about you, but I found that astounding. Now, leisure is one of the key things that define our lifestyles. And so this finding certainly underlines the fact that Resolve is right to be looking at lifestyles. And what's more, up until recently, leisure and how it might become more sustainable has been widely neglected in research. And so it's findings like this that underlay some of the novel studies carried out in Resolve, such as a study of serious leisure activities and a study of the music industry. Now, of course, Resolve is really about how we can improve things in the future. And when we turned our minds to it, it became apparent that a phenomenon called the rebound effect is a huge barrier to progress, but that very little was known about it. So we've set out to assess how bad the rebound effect might be in a study joint with Steve Sorrell at Sussex University. And we've recently published a study that's gaining a great deal of interest. And our study has shown that due to the rebound effect, only around two-thirds of the carbon reductions that we expect when we make pro-environmental behaviour changes might be achieved. So basically, the message that comes out of this rebound study is that if you have money, you'll either spend it or you'll save it. But whatever you do with it, you'll be triggering carbon emissions. So we really need to think about incomes. So what do we need to lead a decent life? Which parts of our consumption are necessary and should be preserved? And which bits could we eliminate without decreasing quality of life? So another of the things we've done is to estimate the carbon footprint of a decent life and compare this to our current footprints. And again, you can hear much more about this work later today. So I'd now like to pass on to David Uzzell.
Okay, I'm here to represent the psychology strand of Resolve. We've sought over the project to explore the implications of key aspects that constitute people, among other things, their values and identities, for their everyday behaviours and practices as they relate to sustainable consumption and production. And of course, how recursively the world out there influences their states of having and being. I and my psychology colleagues, Birgitte Kattersleben, Neve Murta, Vokit Abrahamsa, and Emma White, as you can see, our psychology strand largely comprises researchers with unpronounceable names, have sought to understand what it means to have and to be, and the relationship of these two states for consumption. In other words, what is the relationship between consumption and identity, production and the creation of needs, pro-environmental intentions and behaviours and values? For example, one question we've been interested in is, does identity mediate the link between values and behaviour? And is the relationship between attitudes and behaviours stronger than the link between identities and behaviour? Birgitte will be addressing these issues in a presentation after coffee. We can see identities as relevant factors in people's behaviours. Identities influence how we receive messages around sustainable practices and behaviours. For example, encouraging people to take on a recycler identity results in them recycling more. But to what extent do identities influence travel mode choice? To what extent are transport choices affected by a person's self-identity? As Neve will demonstrate, people hold multiple identities. Do preferences not to drive for environmental reasons conflict with an individual's view of themselves as a responsible parent who needs to escort their children to school for safety reasons, or even live in the countryside because they have strong biospheric values? We know that threatening people's identities may lead to resistance, and threats to identities increase resistance to change. People's identities are strongly tied to their jobs, so threatening industries, because they're high carbon emitters, threatens jobs, which in turn threatens work identities. What sort of policies, processes, and structures do we need to put into place to ensure that not only is the environment protected, but people's psychological well-being is supported too? In preparation for this conference, which I've kind of seen as an academic passing out parade, I looked at our initial aims. A key one was to explore the social and psychological influences on lifestyle and energy consumption, and the relevance of these influences for policymakers seeking to affect behaviour change. Now, I think we can fairly claim to have done this, but perhaps not necessarily in the ways we originally anticipated. It's clear that the field with which Resolve is concerned has changed over the 5 years of Resolve's existence. For example, the discussion of concepts such as behaviour change has become much more nuanced. Does anyone really still believe that information deficit is really the reason for public inaction? Or that it's possible to devise a set of instruments aimed at the public who, like Pavlov's dog, will obediently respond in the ways it intended? Unfortunately, they probably do. But behaviourist models have been replaced by more sophisticated readings of people-environment relationships. The social has been imported in ways that suggest changing environmental behaviours requires changing social, economic, and political processes and structures. One aspect of some of our work in psychology has been to argue that while we may want to change behaviours, it's also important to change the conditions which drive those behaviours. We've explored these ideas through using a life histories methodology, which focuses not on the person as a repository for a collection of traits, attitudes, behaviours, but as a whole person in which their social relations are constituted through everyday practices. The focus of the work of Emma White has been on meat consumption, the production of which is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's an issue which we've also examined in terms of threatened identities. And what we've found is that meat consumption is integral to our identities, our values, and our social relations. Both the individual and behaviour change have to be seen within a social context, and context has to be taken into account if practices are to be changed. The last study raises the issue of challenges. We face many challenges as researchers, as advisors to policymakers, as communicators to society. One such challenge is reconciling the individual with the social and to construct models of behaviour change which are isomorphic with the social structures in which people live. But I think there's another issue coming out of our work in Resolve with which we would like your help. It seems that people are quite comfortable when we're talking about attitudes, social norms, identity, and values, and are relatively optimistic as to what we should do about changing behaviours by means of mediated interventions with these variables. But as soon as we start to talk about changing processes and structures from a socio-psychological point of view, the mood shifts from optimism to pessimism, from engaged enthusiasm to feelings of helplessness. And the question I will pose is, how do we do this? Of course, we can talk of participation, collective action, community resilience, but how do we turn these kinds of actions into a mass movement that bears comparison with the ways we have raised consciousness about individuals doing their bit? The work that we've been undertaking on a project associated with Resolve, examining collective action within the trade union movement in order to change production, may be one approach. And I was really pleased to see Juliet talk about trade unions as agents here. Rob Hopkins this afternoon may provide some suggestions in the context of community initiatives. But like you, I'm looking forward to the rest of the day when we can explore these issues and receive some of your ideas about how we meet these challenges. Thank you very much.
Okay, you might think we've got the same slide all over again, and indeed you have. I should say I came up with it first. David stole it, but I'm very happy to share it in the spirit of interdisciplinary cooperation.
It's called interdisciplinary cooperation.
Exactly, that's what I said, yeah. So what I want to do is just give you a brief overview of some of the sociological strands of work that we've pursued in Resolve. And the concept of sustainable lifestyles has been one that's obviously been very central to our work, and I've made my title here. I've put a question mark at the end of it to indicate that it's a somewhat problematic concept and one that we've approached critically. Of course, both the individual concepts of sustainability and lifestyles are themselves notoriously complex and contested, and combining them only serves to intensify this. So one of the really important strands of work that we've pursued has been around exploring the meanings of sustainable lifestyles. And some of our early work adopted a theoretical approach to this, mining social and cultural theory to develop a sociological perspective on the related concepts of sustainable lifestyles and sustainable consumption. And this involved us thinking through issues of identity, culture, ethics and practice. And that work's gone on to inform and been built on through our subsequent empirical work. So one of our key empirical research interests has been in what a sustainable lifestyle might mean to people. And we've explored this in a range of qualitative and quantitative studies, with those explicitly attempting to live sustainably, with children and young people, and with those engaged in the Transition Town movement. And in all of these studies, we find that understandings of what it means to live sustainably are contested. So while the range of social practices that people report in narratives of sustainable lifestyles unsurprisingly revolve around food, transportation, energy consumption, waste, recycling, and leisure activities, the importance that people give to any of these domains and exactly how sustainable practice in any of them is defined or understood varies quite considerably. We've also observed the internal contradictions and inconsistencies that those attempting a sustainable lifestyle often report. For example, in the Sustainable Lifestylers Project, respondents detailed tensions between their efforts to reduce their environmental impact and at the same time their desires to have a life, to be a bit selfish and to enjoy aspects of consumer culture. I think it's important to emphasise that all of our work on the meaning of sustainable lifestyles has also drawn attention to the inherently political and moral character of attempts to live sustainably. Secondly, by drawing attention to context, I want to emphasise our view that living sustainably is less an issue of individual choice or individual behaviour, as much as something which is enabled or constrained by diverse contextual factors. Alongside studies which are looking at people who are explicitly trying to live more sustainably, our work's also focused on the social, institutional, economic, political, and technical contexts which shape everyday practices, rendering them more or less sustainable. One finding that's come through strongly here is the role played by manufacturers, retailers, and products themselves in escalating unsustainable patterns of demand and consumption. We've observed this in a study of the design, marketing, purchase, and use of laptop computers. Qualitative work within a global IT manufacturing company illustrated the role that supply-side actors as well as consumers play in shaping demand for products. And we've seen something similar in a very different piece of work. In an in-depth exploration of the leisure practices of middle earners, we've observed how local, non-materialistic practices such as gardening, walking, or bird watching can escalate through increasing expectations and market innovations, especially when those promise higher standards of competence or comfort. Of course, the converse of this is the recognition that industry might play a key role in supporting the uptake of more sustainable practices. And one of the ways in which we've explored this is through a case study of the music industry, which examines the ideas of music businesses, artists, and fans on the potential role of music for catalysing low-carbon lifestyles. Political and policy context is critical too, from the international through to the local level. And here we've had projects ranging from analysis of the impact of energy policy frameworks to studies of the role that local government can have in supporting community engagement in low-carbon activities. The role of non-state actors has also been of interest, and in particular we've examined the agency of diverse local and community groups and networks in encouraging adoption of more sustainable lifestyles and mobilising community action. Finally, our work indicates many challenges associated with sustainable lifestyles. I've already mentioned the extent to which the concept is contested and the complex contextual factors which enable or constrain the possibility of sustainable practice. There are also profound challenges of fairness and equity to think through. This has perhaps come out most strongly in the study of leisure practices of middle earners, where it's clear that rising energy prices, while delivering environmental benefits, are likely to result in the loss of meaningful leisure practices for this group. This calls into question both the fairness of using pricing mechanisms to deliver sustainable lifestyles and gives indications of the likely implications of a higher priced energy future for equality and social inclusion. So we come right back to fundamental questions of how we define sustainability and the need for this to include social considerations, especially when policy making. I really hope you enjoy the conference today and you get the opportunity to learn more about some of the pieces of work that we've only very briefly touched upon here.